Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, MacGuffinMen.com, to keep up on our most recent episodes. We most recently talked about Michael Haneke's Funny Games, primarily the 1997 version with a little bit of the 2007 mixed in. First Man was before that, The Towering Inferno before that, and then Mank and Tenet. I also wrote a book. It's called Content About Content. My name is Alex Stevenson, Stevenson with a PH. You can get it on Amazon. Or if you don't want to pay Amazon for it, you can get in touch with me on Twitter at the MacGuffinMen, and I will send it to you. All right, let's get to the episode. All right, James. So we are here talking about The Parallax View, an Alan J. Pakula film. At this point in his career, he's best well known or most well known for Clute, which came out in 1971, and Jane Fonda won Best Actress for the movie. Clute is still well regarded as a movie today, and this was sort of a follow up to that. And Alan J. Pakula is not necessarily famous to film non-super fans, you know, to people who aren't like us, but chances are you've seen one of Pakula's films, no matter who you are, if only because he directed All the President's Men after The Parallax View. And I found this quote from Nathan Heller on the Criterion essay on The Parallax View, where he says, in Pakula's films, people seek out conspiracy. Like Frady, a reporter prowling for a scoop, they're always looking for the darkness and the bright. This active suspicion is distinctly post-60s, both because it values the instinct of the individual over the system, man, and because, befitting a moment after the summer of love had ceded to the summer of the Manson murders, it allows that every good path will eventually turn bad. And that's a really good summation of most of Alan J. Pakula's films, at least the ones that I have seen. And it's certainly a good summation of The Parallax View, which is what we're talking about. So, thoughts? What'd you think about The Parallax View?
I mean, first I'll say, up there with the great conspiracy / spy titles.
Oh, it's so good.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Like every, you know, Robert Ludlum novel, film. great template.
And it also... it has a word that most people couldn't define off the top of their head, but yeah. It's also a word that's fun to say. So then people look up what the definition of the word is, which I think is like the perfect combination for a title. Yeah.
The only thing, and I swear this is the last thing I'm going to say about the title. Mm-hmm. the only thing that works against it is parallax and view are too similar, because parallax is, you know, something that is something different between the two different views that you might have on something. Mm-hmm. I truly like the two completely random words, like the, you know, Aquarian ultimatum or whatever, just anything truly different enough. But anyway, this is very much a movie about different perspectives on things. And we can see how that ties into conspiracies altogether, and just the very nature of the conspiracy theory, that there is some truth that you're not seeing. And of course, it's so hard to take these things away from the 60s and 70s with the assassinations and Watergate, and just this feeling that there are people in control who are hiding things from you. And there's just that sense of paranoia within this movie and Pakula's films. Just that notion of information being withheld, or information or events being looked at from different perspectives and meaning different things from different mm-hmm. people. And that's something that is all throughout this. I mean, it's the text of this movie, but it's the subtext as well. And it's all over the visuals, and you can't get it 2 minutes into this movie without, you know, we have what looks like some Native American artwork in one of the very first shots of this
movie.
It is
the first shot.
Okay, I didn't know if the sort of commission report is before that. But, you know, then we get this slight camera movement and we see the Space Needle. You know, there's this frame where it's all we have is this, I'm going to say totem pole. I don't know if that's 100% correct, so my apologies if it's not. But, you know, then we have a slight camera move and we reveal something so much bigger and so much different. You know, we have this this wooden sculpture that looks somewhat naturalistic, representing animals, and then we have this, I don't know exactly when the Space Needle was constructed, but pretty modern as far as the early 70s is concerned.
Yeah, it was constructed for the 1962 World's Fair.
Okay, there you go. So less than two decades old, and made to look futuristic, not even just modern. You know what I mean? It's called the Space Needle. It's very much this idea of cutting edge and something otherworldly by how advanced it is in its technologies. So, yeah, you can't get very far into this movie without that idea of a change of perspective revealing the a different truth or a different objective reality, and that notion of subjectivity being essential in the way that people are exposed to information, and at least in Frady's case, his desire to seek out information.
Yeah, absolutely. And just continuing on what you're saying about the opening shot, because I think it's an incredible shot. You know, because you're looking at this monument of the Indigenous people of America. This is on July 4th, Independence Day, which is like an American holiday meant to make you feel like that's the beginning of the country of America, which is, you know, like the formation of the name, the United States of America and everything. That is true, but it's not like there weren't people on the land before then. And out of that...
And very much the end of something else, as much as it's looked at exactly as the beginning of one thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you just look at the way that the Space Needle sort of grows out of the totem pole, it's just like, what is it? It's not even a building with a real purpose. It's just this ornament for the city, you know? Yeah. And those tall buildings aren't like those particular types of buildings have no real purpose other than to look cool and to bring people towards your city, right? And it's just something that has I don't know, no use other than to be ogled at, but it is this almost like metaphor for just building something just to build something, to put your mark on the land. Because when you think of one visual element of the Seattle skyline, what do you think of? It's the Space Needle, right?
Yeah.
And it's just to mark your land. And the idea is that, well, you took the land before you could mark it, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not something that is talked about throughout the film at all. It's just a really interesting place to set up this particular movie, even if you never come back to it. It's sort of like, you see the independence of America. Well, as you said, it was the ending of the independence for a different kind of people or a different group of people, right?
Yeah, and to put a finer point on it, and to move a lateral move in the conspiracy world, I guess, the World Trade Center at least was an office building. You know, mm-hmm. You had a lot of businesses in there. You had a lot of things being done in there. But as you said, the Space Needle is really just kind of this dick measuring contest. Yeah. Like, hey, look how big and awesome we're able to construct things now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I live in Toronto. I never have to go to the CN Tower for like a utility for utilitarian purposes.
You can find an expensive dinner somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going grocery shopping at the top of the CN Tower, you know?
Yeah.
So did you like this movie?
Yeah, I did. I will say that my biggest complaint about it is, I mean, it ties into the thing that I like so much about this kind of movie, and I figured this title would come up at some other point, but The Manchurian Candidate is, you know, pretty close within the orbit of this one, mm-hmm. Having been made earlier, but it just seems, it seems kind of in the same family. You know, we talked about what's it kind of known as? The Clute, Parallax View, All the President's Men trilogy?
The Paranoia trilogy.
The Paranoia trilogy. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know if it was Paranoia or Conspiracy, but mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so there's that trilogy, but I think that, you know, if those are all siblings, Manchurian Candidate's a cousin that they spent a lot of time with. but what I like about those movies, and especially Manchurian Candidate, which we've done a podcast on, which was a ton of fun to watch and talk about, is the tone of it. And it has this atmosphere that doesn't, you know, kind of let you out. And I think that for a movie about paranoia, that so important. And I think that this movie has some tonal shifts that really detract from that overall atmosphere, because there are sequences in this film, and I don't think there's a better one than the finale as far as just being visually stunning and being hard to look away from and having a bunch of different compositions within the frame that are you can look at for a long time and kind of notice new things and feel your eyes kind of following the lines and seeing what the cinematographer would want you to look at, which I know we'll talk more about. But I think that what I don't like about this is that that atmosphere breaks, and it breaks a few times, and I think that's pretty glaring for me. But I think it has a ton of very cool tricks up its sleeve. I think that the amount of dialogue and the amount of exposition that is not in this movie is definitely one of its strengths. Mm-hmm. I like a lot of things that aren't in this movie, which I know sounds like kind of a cop out, but I think it was really fun to watch. It was very fun to watch again, and I'm not going to put it up there as my favorite one within this family. But when it's at its best, it's fantastic, and it's just it feels disparate, and it feels like there are. Yeah, I saw some complaints that there's some padding on the runtime, which I can buy into. And I think for a movie like this, it suffers doubly for having those kinds of faults, because I think that the atmosphere is so essential to what I like about the best versions of this kind of movie.
What is something that breaks the atmosphere for you? What's an example?
The Dukes of Hazzard car chase, the bar fight. I think those really do a lot to take me out of this.
Okay.
And I think that the montage is a big shift that I'm okay with. I think that it accomplishes a lot, and I think just as a piece of as a vignette of experimental filmmaking in the middle of this movie, I think it's super interesting. But to me, that loops in more successfully with the themes and the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But I think those more action-y sequences are a little comic, and even on top of that, overly long.
Okay. Well, I love this movie, and I don't really care about those things. they don't bother me. No, I would say that I feel like, it's certainly not All the President's Men to me, but I don't know. I guess I guess I like big action more than most people. I think that's true. I know you and I share an appreciation for that, but I think if you look at it historically, I care less when big action comes out of nowhere. You know, like I'm willing to let that happen because.
Yeah. And historically, by the same token, I think that I'm a bit more. I don't know. I think I separate things a bit more than you do, which is not a qualitative analysis of the way that we watch movies. But I've seen you forgive bad things in movies that you like so much of the rest of.
Yeah.
I can find those things bogged down a bit. They bog down the hole a bit more than I find that you do.
Yeah, and those things that you mentioned happened closer to the middle than the beginning or the end. So that's kind of, if something doesn't annoy me in the beginning or the end, chances are I'll forgive it if the rest of the movie is good. Also, putting a 5-minute experimental movie in the middle of a... in the middle of like a Hollywood film starring one of the biggest movie stars in the world at the time, that buys a lot of leeway, followed by like 18 minutes of no dialogue, followed by maybe 2 minutes of dialogue and then another 15 minutes of no dialogue until the end. Like, sign me up 10 times out of 10, you know, like it's great. And I will say this movie did have its issues in the production of it. Because this movie was made in a small window of time before a looming writer's strike hit and during a very limited window of availability for Warren Beatty, who plays Joe Frady. So that can go one of two ways. It went the other way with Alan J. Pakula's own final film, The Devil's Own, which my understanding is also jumped in a little bit too early, but it just kind of worked out on the Parallax View. And I think when I watch the Parallax View, I see a movie that has been absolutely strengthened by removing things. I have no evidence of this. I have no evidence that there is a 2-hour version of the Parallax View with more dialogue. I just have a suspicion that this movie cut out a bunch of dialogue and just sort of went for the most streamlined version. And I find when, you know, a lot of times I just finished a book by Paul Hirsch, who was one of the credited editors on Star Wars, and a variety of other well-known movies over the years. And one of his tricks is always when something feels wrong about the movie is to just look for a scene to remove. And he says that tends to be a really good way to fix a movie. And it doesn't, you know, obviously it doesn't work every time. Every movie is different. But this movie in particular, even removed from the fact that I just read a book about taking scenes out, helping movies, it really feels like things were removed, because I think that's how you get to a movie with almost no dialogue, is just streamlining a narrative after the fact, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree with that assessment. And I don't know that I considered it in those terms, but I just, in taking notes of this movie, just writing down things that aren't answered, and that this movie just has a ton of time to breathe. And I mean that in, I think when you talked about that scene that doesn't have a lot of dialogue, there's the airplane scene, you know, mm-hmm. there's ambient, there's people speaking nonstop. There's no, you can pick up bits of conversation and, you know, it sounds like you're on an airplane, you know, mm-hmm. it's not this experimental, you know, silent little journey. But none of it's important because the character that we're watching is alone. And yep. so there's no one for him to really speak to except to pay for his plane ticket on the plane or whatever's going on in the 70s air aviation world. I don't yeah. understand. But no, like, in that scene's a really great example of how that's done with dialogue. But then we also have just plot questions unanswered. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just, you know, in these movies where we're dealing with someone who is out of their element, who's investigating something, you know, this is one of those, the hero is an investigator or a journalist, you know, he's not a cop, he's not a private eye, it's just someone who is trying to find the truth out about something, so we're not going to have tons of answers, and mm-hmm. it's not just like, I need to figure out A, okay, that leads me to want to figure out B, and that leads me to want to figure out C. Like, he's just grasping for anything at this point. He doesn't know what he's looking into. He just knows that someone close to him has died, and there's other questions, but that's the most pressing one. So I was wondering if that I was gonna say the other space that you really feel in this is in a lot of the visuals and just these big long shots. And
yeah, I don't think a camera was ever within 10 feet of an actor in this movie, ever. Not once.
Yeah, so we can, I know we'll deal with that, but I just, on that topic of kind of Frady's motivations, do you have a good grip on what is motivating him? And you know, we've talked about him wanting to kind of unearth, he was on site when there is a political assassination, which within the universe of this movie seemed like a very big deal, obviously, and it mm-hmm. seems like a... it was most closely modeled on the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, so it seems like it's supposed to be not quite a presidential assassination, but a pretty important one, you know, like a secretary of state or a governor or a political candidate.
It felt like a senator who was getting ready to run for president. That's the right. That's the feel I get there.
Yeah. And so he's around for this thing. He's around he's at the site of the assassination with, at the point of this, it seems clear that it's his ex-girlfriend, who's Lee Carter, Paula Prentice, the reporter. And she, you know, years later, people keep dying. 6 people have died, and she's worried about her own life. And once, he's pretty dismissive of that, but once she dies, it becomes quite clear that he wants to figure out what's happening here. But mm-hmm. are we meant to believe, or is your understanding of it, I should ask, that he's driven by guilt, grief, or is her death just an exclamation mark that her theory was correct? Or does he want to be a good journalist? Does he want to keep his job because mm-hmm. he seems on the brink of losing it? What do you think is his motivation, and is that important to you in a movie like this?
One, not important. Two, just get it out of the way. I don't care. Well,
or backwards, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And something, I'll get back to answering your question, but I think something that's important to note for this movie and that I think was a really good decision. It seems like very, maybe even after production had started, but like very late in the process, almost too late to change this sort of thing. Joe was originally a cop and they turned him to a journalist. And I think that strengthens this movie infinitely.
Yeah.
And certainly helps it age a lot better, you know?
Because that's more 60s, 70s conspiracy.
Nobody ever looks at a journalist and sees the villain. Where, like, outside of Frank Serpico, you know, you can see like villainous tendencies in most cop characters that we root for in movies, you know. Whereas the journalist is always the underdog because the journalist is always getting squeezed by the corporation who's laying off other journalists. And just outside of like the top layers of people running some sort of journalistic enterprise who care about the money and keeping the business functioning, people that work for these media organizations do so out of an interest in learning and knowing more about the world, you know? And I think that's important for the character of Joe Frady. You know, does that sound wrong?
No, not at all. It's, and I'm not saying that this is the movie that I want or that this would strengthen the movie. I just mean that we don't see him. We don't really see him give a big speech about this, but we don't really get him see a big speech about anything. So, no. Nor do we any character in this really. We don't really get to that moment where, from a character perspective, his objective is to avenge the death of his ex-girlfriend or friend or whatever, or that the people need to know what's happening, pounding on the table, or, you know, I'm going to lose my house because if I don't report this story, then my job, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like we never get, and again, that's not to say that this is the thing that would have raised this movie up in my opinion. This is not very low in my opinion either, but I just didn't know if there was something that you saw that I didn't see where that becomes more clear.
No, not at all. Because
it's just a time period where so many people are thirsty for truth that to make it a bit more anecdotal like that makes it less universal.
I almost enjoy... I don't see something that you don't see. I think there are sometimes in life when you see something and you just become too curious to stop yourself. And I think Joe Frady is a naturally curious person who has a suspicious thing laid out for him by somebody he knows, which he doesn't believe at the time, right? As she's laying it out. And then she, within one cut, is dead. And so... he is a naturally curious person. So his next thought would be, well, maybe she's right. I'm going to look into this. I don't think he cares about his job. I don't think he's particularly protective of himself in general. We never get that feeling about Joe.
No, he would have made a lot of different choices in this movie.
Yeah. I don't think
it's on a plane because there's a bomb on it.
Yes.
Not kind of self-preservation 101.
Yeah. No, I think, and I don't think it's a revenge thing. To like avenge the death of Lee or anything like that. I just think sometimes, especially in these movies, characters see things that they can't unsee and they just have to follow. They have to keep pulling the thread. That's what Joe is to me. He's somebody who just can't stop pulling a thread. And I think anybody in the same position with the same skills as him might feel compelled to do the same thing, you know?
Yeah. And as we were saying about this movie, having a concision that we like and not being overexpository, the nature of their relationship seems crystal clear and done so quickly.
Yep.
As you said, like she dies within a cut, but she's on screen for a short amount of time. When he tries to get in and when she tries to get into the convention meeting, whatever that's in the Space Needle, and Frady claims that he's with her, and the security guard asks, "Ma'am, is he with you?" And she just takes one beat. It's not too long. There's no flashback, but it's this totally loaded moment where she says no. Yeah. And that's okay. They had something. They don't have something. Things aren't settled. You don't know. At this point, you don't really know who ended what or what exactly about what state that they're in or if there's ever hope for them getting back together, but you get a lot, and it's kind of charged but not sappy. And then she comes to his apartment, she sees another woman leaving. There's kind of one comment in passing, and it's not, you know, it's not really cold or sharp or anything. And I just think that a ton is accomplished there, and I think that is emblematic of what this movie does so little, or does so well with so little.
I agree. I also think she is fantastic in the very small role. Like, I think the way that she plays radio reporter waiting for an interview is really fantastic.
I think so too.
Yeah. And also the way that shot is just positioned, I think is very interesting as well. And I just think she does a great job there.
Which shot?
It's the one where she's, where Alston, is that his first name? Alston Tucker, is standing just off to the side, and she's giving her intro about where we are, the expository intro of where this scene is and what's happening. Yeah. And then he comes in to speak. Like, that's just sort of, because it's our first look of the sort of surveillance camera that will become very prevalent throughout the movie. Right. And it's just, but it is a weird shot. And since it's, I think it's the first one of those in the movie, it's the first thing that you have to grasp. And she just gives this very realistic performance in a shot that is staged specifically to add some sort of realism to the feel of it. But yeah, I think she's great. And I also think the cut from them walking out on the balcony together to her in the morgue is just so fantastic. And also, just a sign of the concision in this movie. It's like, we don't need to know how she died. Well, they do tell you how she died, but it doesn't need to take even 30 seconds. It can take less than one. And and it's just fantastic. There's an edit like that include as well. That's really great right off the top. And I don't know to be comfortable doing those sorts of edits is just really cool to me.
Yeah, and this movie isn't as concerned with his grieving or, you know, him falling to his knees, realizing that he let her down or now it's too late or whatever it is.
No, it's not interested in characters explaining why they feel how they feel. Explaining how they feel. It's certainly not interested in explaining why they feel how they feel. And it's not necessarily interested in explaining to you who everybody is or what they're doing or why that tuba player doesn't know how to play the tuba. And then eventually you just figure it out because... The movie trusts you, you know?
Right.
It doesn't trust anything else but the viewer.
For a movie about not trusting anything, it does an okay job of trusting the viewer.
Yeah, because there is so much that in the shitty version of the Parallax View, there's like an ADR line of somebody saying, the tuba player works for Parallax or something. Or like those people just watching above the convention center saying, oh, our tuba player is down there keeping an eye out or whatever, you know? That's why this movie's good. That's why.
Yeah. Do you have an idea of why they're killing all the witnesses to the assassination?
No.
Yeah.
Because you got to control everything. I don't know. Let's not think too hard about the motivations of the monolithic corporation that can't be stopped and runs everything, you know, because
I know that there's a lot of things that are unanswered here, but I also believe that there are some questions that are answered by showing one character in a location once. So there is a chance that I didn't see something or hear something, I just didn't know.
No, I think it's to clean up. And in like, these are so many deaths that I don't think this cleans up an assassination at all. I think it makes it way messier. like their actual strategy, you know, like what's the number that you get to when you're like, okay, I think we might be killing too many witnesses.
Yeah,
you
know, like, this was on TV. Now do we have to kill everyone who was watching TV?
Yeah, exactly. So like, I think if you start raising questions about the motivations of Parallax, then, you know, that's a thread of this movie that sort of hurts it if we start as the viewer pulling it. But I just don't think I care about that, you know.
No. Yeah. I don't think you do either.
Yeah, kill as many witnesses as you need to make the Parallax View as a movie happen.
Yeah. And throw as many small vehicles into this film as you can.
We've talked about the cinematography a bit. We haven't talked about who the cinematographer is. It's Gordon Willis, who is What
POD.
we talk? Sorry,
The Prince of Darkness.
Yeah, exactly. As coined by Owen Roizman, I think, another cinematographer who shot Network. One of the most famous cinematographers who ever lived, when we were talking about Mank, I quoted David Fincher saying that Greg Toland was one of the three greatest cinematographers who ever lived. I'm certain Gordon Willis is one of the other two that that he was referencing. Also, for anybody that has seen Zodiac, they know that David Fincher is an All the President's Men super fan, which Willis also shot. And I think the cinematography in this movie is fantastic, and it's so interesting and totally different from All the President's Men. It's a lot closer to Clute than it is All the President's Men, where in All the President's Men, it's just this very... It's this very, like, straight away, we're looking at the world as Woodward and Bernstein would see it, you know? And similarly, the soundtrack of All the President's Men is totally different in that that movie is nothing but exposition, but it's just interesting exposition, you know? Whereas this movie, Parallax View, doesn't tell you anything. But
yeah,
the main thing that is really interesting about the Parallax View and the way that it's shot is, as I alluded to earlier, the camera never feels like it's even in the same room as a person. Like most interiors, certainly at the time, and still to this day, most interiors in a movie, they're shot in a studio as opposed to a proper location. And it's, you can really tell when we see Warren Beatty in this small apartment making whatever he's making on that stove as somebody's coming to the door, and we get this wide shot of the whole space, but it still feels like the camera is just 1,000 feet away from him in a way that, like, the wall would be in the way, you know? Yeah. Like, just the wall doesn't exist because you're on a film set. And that happens constantly. There are even examples where the lens is a bit longer, and so you're not getting quite as wide of a shot. I'm thinking of when he's going to the motel desk early on, when Joe's going to the motel desk that he lives at and getting his messages, where it's just this weird, it's not really a proper medium, it's not a close-up, and the lens is longer, but the camera is still very far away. And it's just this weird construction that always, and the idea is that you're always being watched from afar. You know, this is a pretty standard idea in cinematography and movies about surveillance or paranoia. It's just in this one, they go all the way with it. And I find it so fascinating how there never feels like there's a camera in the same room as Warren Beatty. It feels like he's being shot from one room over. You know, it's somebody on a telephoto lens, not literally necessarily using a zoom lens, but like a photographer trying to keep tabs on Joe from the other room. And that's the way the eye of this camera feels all the time, with the exception of the opening shot, which was a decision because it's just loaded with meaning, you know? And I just find that so cool. It's just such an interesting way to shoot the movie.
Yeah, and there's that idea of surveillance, which I agree 100% with what you said, and I think that we see it in other films about surveillance and things we've talked about, The Conversation and other movies.
Enemy of the State.
Yeah, anyway, the best example of that, I suppose.
Hey, Enemy of the State predicted the Patriot Act. I think that's a great film. Continue.
But I think in this one, especially when he goes to Salmon Tail and is trying, you know, he sees that as the next piece of his journey, and that it is in a way, but he discovers Parallax there, but what the deputy and the sheriff are up to, and that it was, he finds out that they're upset that they thought he was looking into this utility scandal. Some of these shots far away of the dam and the two of them fighting, and that he seems to be under the impression he's about to kind of unravel something, and it's not at all what he thought it was going to be. I get the sense that it's trying to convey this feeling that you're such a small part of this giant thing. And that it goes hand in hand with this idea of surveillance, of something being so far away that you know, there's this secondary observer. But I also just always get this sense that you're part of something so much larger than you realize. And as he kind of starts to put the pieces together of Parallax, that does become clear. And that even Parallax is the idea that they're involved in some of these things doesn't do anything to illustrate what they're up to or who runs them or how they're being funded. You know, like there's still a thousand questions to be asked. And these big, the shot of the dam, especially as they're fighting, it's such a cool location. I mean, the action's so interesting, and that it's so downplayed by not being being viewed very closely. But just this idea seems to run throughout it that he's doing everything he can, and that this is his whole world. But even the composition of this film is always there to reinforce that he's only a part of this. He's not even a cog of the machine. He's like a guy knocking on the outside of the machine, trying to get a look at one cog. Like he's so distant from truly exposing or understanding himself the nature of what he's getting involved with. And I think that distance, I think, expresses that visually really well.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree entirely. It's a scorching hot take from the MacGuffin Man. This movie shot by Gordon Willis is shot very, very interestingly and very well. And I think, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm not meaning to belittle your point, because it was a good point. I was just, I didn't really have anything to add.
No, I understand that. It's the distance is one thing, but then all the geometric shapes, and I mean, there's 10,000 to choose from, but without jumping ahead, I think that the ending is a great example when they're flipping all those cards. You know, they all have these little panels in their hand and flip them over at the same time to show Abraham Lincoln or whoever it may be. But these geometric shapes and people being framed in windows and I'm just not expressing it well because there's so many examples of it, but there's just all these right angles and all these, it's whether it's the windows outside of an office building making these gigantic grids, or those presidential faces on the grids that I was discussing. This idea of repetition, and then we'll have, you know, a 10 by 10 of anything, you know, whether it's windows or tiles or or cars in a parking lot or seats on an airplane. There's just this numerary nature of these things, just this repeated sign or these repeated people or spaces or seats or windows, that they're just, there's such a volume of these things, and then one of them is important to us, and just the anonymity of it, and how many times we see the same thing over and over, and there's meaning to one of them, or they all sum up one meaning. But that idea of having so many of one thing, and only and the viewer only having a way into understanding just one of them, really illustrates Frady's journey of trying to make sense of something that is so much bigger than him. And that's what we get with the conspiracy, you know. It's even when we put together a conspiracy theory, we understand that that's 1% of it, and that with all of this investigation, research, and thinking about it, and people literally dying to try to find information about it, that we're still so distant from it. And I think that if you're living through a time period like the 60s and 70s, and you're trying to piece together what's happening in these gigantic global events, that just that sheer size of it, I think, is what's overwhelming. And as a member of the public, I can see that being something that's so intimidating, that using these, not motifs because they're all on the screen at the same time, but overall, I guess it's a motif by the number of times they use it. That's what seems so intimidating and overwhelming, and that's what Frady's up against for this entire, I mean, 98% of this film.
Yeah, for sure. This is that is something that is in all three of the quote unquote paranoia trilogy, but it is the most prevalent in the Parallax View, which is the most stylized of those three movies, I would say. But I think something that sort of ties to talking about the editing, which I think we should move on to, is the close-ups in this movie were all shot on, this is from John Boorstin, who was a assistant to Alan Pakula at the time of this movie, because they were rewriting, and Gordon Willis likes to in his words, he'd like to shape the whole visual feel of the movie. And since there was no hole to shape, he would just shoot every close-up with the exact same lens from the exact same distance, because then he knew they would all cut together. And he would get annoyed with shooting characters walking in and out of scenes, which apparently they did a lot of for this movie, because he thought they would all get cut, and he called them in his words, just damn shoe leather, which is funny. And there are a lot of funny Gordon Willis quotes out in the world for you to find. If you want to read even one interview with him, you'll have a laugh, I promise. But it does lead to something else that I really like about this movie. We talked about the concision, but I think the editing in general is really interesting, and what you're talking about is being the look of the movie playing into how it would feel to be a member of the society at this time. I think the way that the editing feels so fractured in between these shots with all these lines and like the world is bigger than you. Sometimes within like a scene, you just don't get two shots can be within the same scene, but don't connect like they would in a regular movie. I'm thinking of when Lee comes to see Joe in his hotel room and the other woman exits. When we get that close-up of the other woman and the cut to back to Lee's close-up of the other woman leaving in front of her, like most movies would put some sort of medium or a wide shot of the whole room in between those two cuts, but yeah, you just get the two close-ups, and this happens all throughout the movie. Joe in the police station early on as well, after his parrot is loose on the balcony. That happens pretty frequently in this movie, and it just sort of gives this like fractured, you can never totally grab on to anything. You're either seeing something like from far away. I mean, I guess the camera placement is always far away, but just this you're seeing a lot of visual space, or you're seeing almost none, and then they don't reposition you in between different shots in those sequences. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I think it's fantastic. I like it a lot. And I think that that really plays into everything you were saying about the visuals, but just from an editing perspective. You know?
Yeah. And that I think that drives home this idea of that subjective view, that shot between that you're talking about, either an establishing shot off the top to give you a geography of where they are, so that when you do the close-ups, you know, okay, the Lee standing in front of the sliding doors, and when we see that unnamed woman, I'm sorry, I'm not giving her a name, she doesn't have a name in this movie, as far as I understand, and she's by the bedroom door or whatever. Since we have that establishing shot, even before they were both standing there, we know generally the distance between them, but we're not given that. And we're forced into these really subjective views, and I think that this is a movie about subjectivity and limited information, and when they take that those establishing shots or those reestablishing shots away from us, we're just forced into these spots. And you do get that sense where we've talked about these really wide shots and how those are meaningful, but those close-up shots and those shots that are missing, where we connect those ideas, where we connect those locations, really ground us into the eyes of the camera, and we don't get to rove with that camera. We don't get to look around. We don't get to understand everything about the geography of this room. And I think that that's what we're meant to have, is this sense of only seeing what you're allowed to see, and even if you're craving more, you're not given it. And that might not even occur to you right away, and it didn't occur to me right away either. But it does sort of just leave you with that visual and mental state of wanting more, and to wanting a complete understanding of something that you're just not given. And,
yeah,
and that's what happens with Frady for the runtime of this movie. He's never given everything he wants to know. And as the viewer, we're never given it either.
Yeah. And referring back to a cut that we've already talked about, the one from the balcony to the morgue, you know, from Joe's perspective, like, what do you do as soon as you find out that Lee has died? You think to yourself, I just talked to her. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right.
And so from a subjective perspective, that really puts us in his shoes, you know?
Yes.
And that fractured feeling, like, those are two those are two moments that would always be linked in his head anyway. The last time you see a person, and then when you go to the morgue and you see their dead body, like if you had to actually live those two things, I don't think you could separate those two memories from each other, assuming they happened relatively close to each other. And it's just a really cool, good subjective move, I think, you know?
Yeah, no, you're right. I was still focused on the shot composition of it, but I think that you're right to point out that that's an editing choice. You know, yeah. That's another piece of cinema language that they're using to make this jarring subjective understanding.
Yeah.
You're right that that's how that would feel, I imagine. You're like, you don't remember her walking home, or you know what you did that day between you finding her presenting this idea into you finding her dead. It's in your memory. It's that, yeah, as you said, it's that short, non-existent time in a linear sense between her being alive and argumentative and vivacious and, you know, full of energy and life, and then she's on a slab somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. He's not going to remember the sad bologna sandwich that he ate in between those two instances, you know? And I think there are very few moments like that, that sort of combine, that really give you a subjective feeling of somebody in a scene. And like we said, you get Joe's perspective there. The other time, and this is with editing and cinematography really working in concert, not that they don't always, but especially from a subjective point of view here, is the first assassination attempt, the opening scene, when we get the senator's shot, and we get the I think only time in the movie where a camera like whips around, and it's just super fast pan to follow the alleged assassin as he's running out, and that's specifically from a perspective of meant to be from the perspective of somebody who witnessed this assassination. You know, what do? Yeah. You look around for the person that killed the senator, and that is an edit that isn't in the rest of the movie, and it's a camera shot that isn't in the rest of the movie to my recollection. And that's another just moment of subjectivity, and there are very few instances where this movie like gives you something to grab onto from inside the scene as opposed to from outside of it, which is where we are for the rest of the movie. Usually there's this overarching just parallax will control everything at all times, but those are two instances where they give you something to grab onto from a film grammar sort of way for people inside of the scene. And I just thought those were interesting choices.
Yeah. Should we talk about parallax
as a corporation?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, how?
I mean, this is kind of my point. I don't. Yeah. I mean, this might be a bit macro or conclusive. Should we talk about that airplane scene a bit more? Do you think we've covered what we need there?
I think it's self-explanatory. Unless you have something to say, like it's just, I don't think we can. It's a wordless scene that is done so well, and it's really interesting that he is stuck in the position of not wanting that bomb that's on the plane to go off because it will kill him, but also not being able to be identified as the person who says, like, he can't be remembered on this flight because then he's the suspect. And I think that's the really interesting nugget of that scene is him navigating those two things. But other than that, I think the scene is, it's really great, but I just don't have a lot to say about it.
I think it's super strong. And that hadn't even really occurred to me initially of why there had to be this distance between him and that reveal. Mm-hmm. And him writing on the mirror with soap was really cool. And there is just this tension in that scene because there is always this threat that the bomb's going to go off, but you're kind of not that concerned that the bomb's going to go off just because of the runtime of this film.
Exactly.
And it does find that workaround, I think, is what makes this still so intriguing of how is he going to make this fact known without being so clearly indicted and having so little to fall back on and say, oh, I saw a man leave a building and, you know.
He also just personally needs to know why the bomb is on the plane. So first he has to find that reasoning, which is that the senator is on the plane. Yeah.
Yeah, and an example another umpteen million of just information being unavailable to him and to the viewer, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just think it's so successful in how little there is to grasp onto. You know, we see him try the mirror thing and it doesn't work, and that scene is devoid of tension if we're just worried about the bomb going off, because we know it's not going to, because it can't, mm-hmm. barring some stupid scene where he survives it. And he already survived the boat thing, so let's not blow up another thing that he's done and make it okay. But just the fact that there's all the dialogue that we talked about, and there's nothing really for us to grasp onto. There's no one for him to really grasp onto. There's no him teaching another character what to do, which is always the way in to vocalize these things. You know what I mean? Yeah. That doesn't exist. And he comes up with this idea of the napkin note. And anytime you're, you know, like gripping your armrest as a viewer, wondering how many napkins are going to be given every person, and how if it's just the next person, he's in trouble because it's so odd. Like I found that just a very successful way. Like what's at stake here is the whole airplane, but what's at stake for our main character is him getting away with it. Mm-hmm. What we're watching is something, you know, this thing that most people have experienced is the drink cart going up and down the airplane aisles, but just the most interesting version of that's ever existed. Mm-hmm. And this movie does the dam fight sequence well. It has these big set pieces that I think are interesting. It has some action set pieces that I don't find interesting that I've already talked about, but it does find these spaces to do things in a new way, and I think that's one just successful example of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're left with not a ton of answers. You know, he just kind of survives this. He just kind of knows that he's onto something large, but not a ton is gained through that. But we ratcheted up the stakes. We've seen that Joe is good at his job. You know, he's smart and he thinks on his feet. And it's one of those that I think the seed has already been planted that he might be a good parallax employee. Mm-hmm. You know, like he has the skill set that they're looking for, and not just being 6'2", but he has these skills that it's something that's really not leaned into. And I think a lesser film leans on this dichotomy of he could be on the right side of things as an investigator, or he could use these skills that he has to go to the other side. And that's an interesting thing that they don't really overdo about him being a good parallax candidate, is mm-hmm. that he has the skill set and seemingly chooses to use it for good.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But he is led around by parallax, and he thinks he's following somebody, but then he's also being followed to make sure that the following is working, which is a really interesting thing that I really like. That character is credited as Jack Younger following him around as he's following around the parallax assassin to make sure that he gets to the convention center or whatever that building is called where the final assassination happens. And because this movie is...
I'm happy to call it Convention Center from here on out.
Yeah, okay, great. Because this movie starts and ends with the same thing. It starts with, it starts with an assassination where we see that there are two people worth considering, but only one of them is considered because he dies. Also, that shot on top of the Space Needle is amazing, and the sound in that shot is amazing, of just the wind and the footsteps on the Space Needle. Like, it's so fantastic. Like
their whole fight sequence up there, which is so non-glamorous, and
it's one shot. It's exactly one shot. Yeah,
that's true too. Yeah,
it's fantastic. But you know, we sort of at that point, we're left to believe that there's a second shooter who gets away, but we can still believe that that first guy is in on it. And then at the end of the movie, it's just this one other person. And then he led that other waiter to the point where he could get blamed for the assassination. And what happens at the beginning then happens at the end to Joe, to Warren Beatty. And it's really interesting watching him follow somebody and then seeing that Jack Younger character peek his head out and just remind you that no, Joe's not in control. You know, like Joe, yeah. Joe thinks he's doing something under his own, you know, volition.
Volition.
Yeah, but... exactly. But it's, he's doing what Parallax wants him to. And he's only going to find that out all too late. And that's I think the really fascinating thing about this movie and just Parallax as a unexplained corporation and overseeing entity is just that they're always in control whether or not you think they are, you know. And it's really cool, you know, from a movie perspective, not from a worldwide does Parallax exist sort of perspective.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and I think that's one of the things I did enjoy thinking about a lot about this movie is where Parallax fits in, because we learn so little about them, and we've talked about some of the things we like about this movie the most is how much, you know, the space and what's unexplained in this. And I think that's what's so terrifying about Parallax is we never get the sense that they're ideologically motivated. And in fact, anything made explicit about them is that they're not. It seems to be more of a corporate entity than... as I said, something that's ideologically motivated. Mm-hmm. It's not a, you know, the vast right-wing conspiracy or this left-wing conspiracy. It's not this hidden part of the government. And I think that it's a bit of this indictment of the corporate side of America, like that, yeah. That there's just this, it's all we really get to know about Parallax is that they kill people. They're pretty good at what they do. They're pretty opaque. And it's this sort of like really successful, violent temp agency, essentially, which is in a way more terrifying than anything, you know, that it's in this capitalist sense that they're just, they found this gap in the market, and what they're able to do is hire the right people who don't understand what they're doing, but you can hire them to do what you want them to do. Mm-hmm. Like if you're a powerful enough entity with enough money and an interest in shaping global policy through assassination, then this company's services are for you. Mm-hmm. And, like, and that it's these, and especially around this time when assassinations of very prominent American figures were still at the forefront of everybody's minds, and that's something that you would see on the news with some regularity, and I don't mean everyday regularity, but if this happens every year, that's an incredibly terrifying thing to happen.
Yeah, there was something like an absurd number of assassinations and or attempts at assassinations within like an 18-year period that I wish I had written that line down. That was just really staggering to me. And I don't think we can grasp how that would feel to live in a world like that until you do, you know?
Yeah. It's not that the world now is perfect by any means, but when these individuals that you've known and you've seen on the news frequently for literally years are just shot in public with, again, any amount of regularity, it must just be so terrifying and unsettling. And I think that there is... we may have talked about this in some of our other paranoia conspiracy theory podcasts, yeah. But there is this notion of understanding conspiracy theories and being attracted to conspiracy theories just because they have some kind of order to the world, that if all of these are being, all these assassinations are being planned by one group of people, that there's some comfort in that, yeah. That at least like there's order to the world in some sense.
Yeah, at least somebody's in control, even if you're not, you know.
That's, yeah,
exactly. I mean that's also the idea behind religion too, you know?
Yeah, and so that this idea that there's lone wolves and like the killers and assassins that are doing so much to shape the world through individual self-motivated actions, mm-hmm. Is super terrifying. And so this idea that Parallax is this company that doesn't have any guiding principles, so you can't even truly agree with them. They're just subcontractors and mercenaries for hire. That's really scary. Mm-hmm. And I think that this movie plays on a lot of those fears, and these shots of skyscrapers and these big buildings, and the way that we see the Parallax Company not as some shadowy, you know, bunch of trailers on the outskirts of society, but it's, you know, handsome men in suits that function within these gigantic buildings and, you know, seemingly right into the in the downtowns of major cities, is really unsettling. And I think that is one of the fears that is played upon, that is it's deeply involved in, you know, American society, that people are willing to do these things for money.
Yeah. And the final assassination, shall we talk about that?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, the because it sort of leans into the that sort of like all-seeing entity idea of just being watched over, because, you know, we get that weird little office that they watch over in the convention center as we get the shot of them looking at this door. We don't understand why that shot is there, and then we cut away to something else, and then we cut back to that shot of the door, and it's because they're waiting for one of your beloved tiny transportation devices, a golf cart driven by the senator, to come in through that door. And we get that shot of the door closing behind him, and we just get total darkness because this guy is driving into somewhere he will not leave. And it's that sequence is incredible. I love everything about it. I love whoever is playing that senator. I think he's an incredible, like, old-fashioned politician. There's something about the appeal of him that is so funny to me. Like, he looks like he's been in the sun for 80 consecutive years just smoking cigarettes and playing golf with no shirt on or something. The fact that he's standing there, the way that he greets people in this, like, I'm giving you as much personality as I can in as little amount of time as possible as I can, like, hey, great to know you, Pat, and then just moving on. Yeah. And saying different things to each person in this very politician sort of way, that's like, I have to do this all the time, and I need to make all these people think that I care about them, but I also don't want it to turn into a conversation, because if all of those hellos turn into conversations, then his day is 10 hours longer. And the way that he is just there to walk up on stage and smoke a cigarette and talk about golf while his own words play over the sound system for a rehearsal is just fascinating. And then, of course,
yeah, they still applaud like he's doing the real speech, but he's doing his golf swing, you know.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't even care to listen to the speech because it's just internalized at that point. He doesn't need to rehearse it anymore, I guess. Or he knows he'll rehearse it later, one of those two, probably both. And then just as he's driving out, just the look that we get while all of this is intercut with Joe running around on scaffolding. No, scaffolding can't be the right word. What would we call where he is?
A catwalk?
Yes, catwalk. That's exactly right. Running around on there, still following the other assassin, while also trying not to be seen by the other people that are up there. And then he's just eventually left alone. The second assassin basically locks him on there. And then he gets blamed for the assassination, which is, I think my favorite shot in this movie, single shot in this movie, is that very wide shot that we've already seen of the convention center, of all these tables that have set up after the senator has been shot. And he's just still dry. He's like, the golf cart still has a little bit of energy behind it, but he's dead. And it's just like, knocking tables out of the way, and I just think that's such a compelling image, and just that whole sequence is just so interesting, and it's so quiet, and it does so much of what this movie has already done well, but does it even better than anything that has come before it. And it's just like a really effective action sequence in a way that most action sequences just wouldn't do. Like, there's no music, you know, it's just footsteps, a gunshot, and then the sound of tables echoing around as they're getting knocked around by that golf cart. And I just think it's an incredibly effective sequence.
Yeah, and what we were saying before about it's hard to really place yourself in this time period, but having seen these prominent figures killed by what you presume is people more powerful, we have this distant scene below us, and it's red, white, and blue, and there's a certain order to it, you know, the way that all these all the tables are set up in these nice lines and represent the flag, and we've got the, once again, you know, these beautifully composed scenes and these straight lines, and you can feel your eyes sort of following the lines that have been set up and looking around. But it really feels like the end of this country, you know. And I know that feels like an overstatement now, but it just the idea of these prominent figures being killed around you in Watergate and Vietnam, that probably would have felt extremely insurmountable at the time. And as you said, with just that golf cart sort of with that last bit of energy and this dead man on it, just this visual metaphor of something coming to its end and this really clunky destruction of the end of it, while up above there is what's really happening, or and what caused these things. Yeah. And just that idea of these two levels, and there is this, there's still this, the glamour of this convention center, you know, just because it was so opulent and so well designed and thought out and aesthetically pleasing. But there's this cart crashing through it. There's ambulances and cop cars squealing and just all these visual representations of trying to stop the bleeding and trying to make sense of something that was once powerful. And salvaging what's remaining and hoping it can continue this way, but then functioning up above it is these other forces at play. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's such an interesting shot that vivifies so much of what this movie has spent, you know, an hour and 10 minutes before this making clear. And then in this very abstract but still compelling way, in an action sequence, but entirely different action sequence, as you said, telling the story and driving these points home and bringing some kind of finality to it.
Yeah, exactly. And even that, when Warren Beatty's like trying not to be, or Joe's trying not to be seen on that catwalk, and he's crawling around, like even just the framing of the way that we're like just seeing him crawl around the edge of a very wide frame in shadow.
Darkness.
Exactly. Yeah. Like he's an insect or something. And it's Warren Beatty, you know, like he's an unbelievably famous man. And, and just, yeah, all of those things like combined to this concoction of something that, I haven't really seen in any other movie. Like, before or since, you know, it's just this, it's this very unique sequence, that last assassination, everything about it.
And, yeah, no, 100%.
Yeah. And similarly, like when the senator is wheeling in and we get that that extra long shot of the door closing behind him, and just leaving us with total darkness, we get Joe getting an opportunity to run to light for the first time in that sequence in a long time. And it's that door has been opened for left open, and we don't really know why, but he's going to run towards it because he has to. And the idea again is that he's trying to run towards his freedom, but the idea is that he's running exactly where they want him to so that he can get shot. And he like the senator, he comes into darkness and never gets to leave. He gets the illusion of maybe getting back to the light, but it's just not going to happen because the second assassin's just waiting for you. I do want to talk about the test very briefly. Because it's impossible to really, like, it's not like I was sitting here and pausing and writing down each subsequent image and how long it was on screen for. I think it's a very impressive sequence. It combines a lot of things that I like about 70s audio recording, like the drum sounds are amazing. The background humming is fantastic. I love that the song has no lyrics. All of these things combined, and it just sounds fantastic. But the thing that I find the most interesting is that, so take the most comparable sequence. It's something similar happening in A Clockwork Orange, Kubrick's adaptation of A Clockwork Orange, right? Where the eyes are like propped open and all these things. We get reaction shots of that character. This, in the parallax view, Joe sits down in a chair, not unlike the... somebody watching a movie does, either at home, I mean more at home because there's nobody around you, or in a theater, and he sits down and he just ingests these images that are projected in front of him, right? But we never see how Joe feels about them. We never get a cut to Warren Beatty's face for the entire test, and that is just,
and you don't even get like an over the shoulder, not even seeing his face but watching him watch, right?
Exactly. There's nothing. You go to the full screen and you don't come out of it until it's time for him to get out of the chair and the lights come up. And that is just a wild decision. And it's so cool. And it is a full 5-minute sequence. I mean, not quite 5 minutes, but like 10 seconds short of 5 minutes. And
which is incredibly long for
it's so long.
Short film vignette of weirdness.
Yeah. And I just, I think it's really interesting that he sits down in the exact same way like a theoretical movie audience would, either individual or a collective in a theater. And this whole movie is being about not being able to trust anything that you look at. And then we are looking at exactly the same thing he has seeing in this movie where we're told not to trust anything that we're looking at. And so then what do we think about? We think about our own experience watching the entirety of the parallax view. We think about like just media in general. And it's just like everything you're told by mass media is a lie. And just all of these things that I recognize are just like, just cascade or just pile on top of each other. And it just ends up being a Sunday of things that don't make sense because you just keep asking questions with no answers and it just never goes anywhere. It's the thread you just can't stop pulling. And I think the something that I really enjoyed is the placement of Thor, the comic panel of Thor that gets repeated a couple times, and we see it right after the word me once, and just the idea of the media feeding you just story after story of you being the hero. And people, you know, we've seen a million movies where people who look like Warren Beatty are the hero and save whatever they have to save. And this movie's all like, that's bullshit. It's a lie. He's going to die. And you shouldn't believe that you can fix anything either. And then you just go back to the opening sequence, or sorry, the opening shot that we've already talked about, and what happens? It's it shows the bigger building. Like, we reveal this bigger building out of this sort of the totem pole, and it's just the idea of the opening shot, and it's the idea of every shot following, is that the bigger corporation has been winning battles since day one and will continue to forever. And even to the point where, as we said, they got to decide what day one was. You know, it wasn't the actual day one, but Independence Day is day one of America, you know? And it's just, it's interesting. And I think the parallax view asks, leaves you with so many questions because it refuses to tell you anything. And it just sort of lets you sit there from a very far distance watching this movie, and I just think it's fascinating. I love it. It's great.
I agree.
Okay. So thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Men, and check back next time.